Until now, the Lord has helped us. Terrell's version had thus far, correct? Thus far, the Lord has helped us. 1 Samuel 7 is where we are. 1 Samuel 7 and 8. This phrase, until now or thus far, the Lord has helped us, this has two meanings, really. Two different inflections. It depends how you place the emphasis on the phrase. Two different outcomes. Ponder this as we go through this lesson. This phrase, and what I've been trying to do as we go throughout the book of Samuel, choosing the what I think is the key phrase or key verse as the sermon title, and I think in this story, 7 and 8, 1 Samuel 7 and 8, this is the key phrase because of this double meaning that it has. We'll talk about this more as we go through. The story in 1 Samuel chapter 7. Of course, we begin in 1 Samuel chapter 7 beginning in verse 3 as we've just got done with this whole incident with the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark's been returned to Israel. And Samuel in verse 3 and following, Samuel said to all the house of Israel, if you are returning to the Lord with all your heart, it's interesting there. It's not necessarily saying that they are, but if you are returning to the Lord with all your heart, then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your heart toward the Lord and serve Him only, and He will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. So the people of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtaroth, and they serve the Lord only. Verse 5. Then Samuel said, gather Israel all at Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. So they gathered at Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord and fasted on that day and said there, we have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel judged the people of Israel at Mizpah. So they're all gathered at Mizpah. They're coming back to God. That's what they're doing. After this prolonged period of absence, this prolonged period of rebellion and wandering away after these other gods, these foreign idols, Samuel says, come back. So they do. And as they're doing this, it's so ironic, it's interesting, the Philistines, as if they haven't already had enough. They just went through this whole ordeal with the Ark of the Covenant, as if they haven't quite figured it out yet. Verse 7, and the Philistines heard that the people had gathered at Mizpah, and the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. Skip down to verse 8. And the people of Israel heard it, and they were afraid of the Philistines. And the people of Israel said to Samuel, do not cease to cry out to the Lord our God for us, that He may save us from the hand of the Philistines. Of course, we know how this concludes, right? As Samuel does offer this sacrifice, and this Philistines are routed, as was read for us in the scripture reading. The Philistines are routed that day before Israel. Feels like just rinse and repeat. Over and over and over. It's the same story. It's the same thing again. And so as Samuel, through this victory, this great victory over the Philistines, judges Israel. We'll read then in verse 14. The cities that the Philistines had taken taken from Israel were restored to Israel from Ekron to Gath, and Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines, and there was peace between Israel and the Amorites, and Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. And then we get an interesting flash into how that process would have worked. Because, you know, at this point, Israel doesn't have a king. Israel doesn't have a centralized government, as it were. It's this collection of 12 tribes, the tribes of Israel. They've kind of got this self-governing thing going on. But Samuel is the judge, the one who settles their disputes, the one who gives them wisdom from God. And he does so in this circuit, verse 16. He went on a circuit year by year to Bethel, Gilgal, Mizpah. He judged Israel in all these places. And then he would return to Ramah, for his home was there. And there also he judged Israel, and he built there an altar to the Lord. Again, they don't have a centralized government at this point. So as he's going throughout this circuit of Israel, people would come to him with problems, they'd come to him with questions, they'd come to him needing guidance from the Lord, and he would give it to them as he goes throughout this circuit. But we see a turn in chapter 8, 8, 1 through 5. We'll begin in verse 1 of chapter 8. Samuel became old, and he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of his second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain, and they took bribes and perverted justice. Samuel's sons did not walk in the way of the Lord as Samuel did. We're sensing a pattern here as we go throughout this book. We'll talk about that. And in part because of Samuel's sons' failings, Israel demands a king. Up until now in the history of Israel, judges had been fine. We've got a whole book of judges. Like the previous book is all about the judges of Israel, right? And up until now, this system had worked great. But it's like Israel's finally gotten fed up. I don't know exactly what the problem is. Well, we'll get to that as we go on. Beginning in verse 4 then. All the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." But this thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them." Up until this point, again, they didn't need a king. They had not needed a king all throughout their history up until now. They were doing fine. As they'd come into the land of Canaan, God had been leading them through these judges, through these prophets. And I don't know, it's maybe they, well, we'll get into that. I don't want to get ahead of myself. So Samuel warns the people, verse 10. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king. He said, "These will be the way of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots." And then he goes on to talk about all the ways in which the king would make their lives miserable. Ways that they would not expect, ways that they would not be happy with, ways that they would not approve of, that this king would make their lives bad. All of these different ways. And he warns them, and you'd think they'd get it, but no. Verse 19, "But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. They said, 'No, but there shall be a king over us that we may be like all the nations, and our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.'" And maybe it's because of the battles with the Philistines. They finally just got fed up of fighting their own battles. They want a king, A, to be like the other nations, but B, so that they don't have to fight anymore. Which I guess I understand that to a certain degree. But all this baggage that was going to come along with the king, they didn't get it. So they finally get their king. This is the story. And it hinges on that phrase. It hinges on that phrase in verse 12. "Then Samuel took up a stone and set it up before Mizpah and Shen and called its name Ebenezer, for he said, 'Till now the Lord has helped us.'" Again, as we think about that, think about the double meaning of that as we go on through this. A couple of notes from the text. One, notice Israel's attitude readjustment. Between last week and this week, we looked at this story, 4, 3, and 4. 1 Samuel 4, 3, and 4, you think it's the same thing, but there is a subtle difference in Israel's attitude. Both battles with the Philistines. In chapter 4, the Philistines come to battle, they lose, and what do? Chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. "When the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, 'Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant from here to Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies.'" And as we looked at last week, they were treating God with contempt. "God, come save us. We deserve it. God, come bring the Ark of the Covenant. Don't ask God about it. He doesn't matter. Let's just get this battle won." But there's a shift in attitude. Then we come to 7, 1 Samuel 7, 8 through 10. Same thing happens. The Philistines come against Israel. "And the people of Israel said to Samuel, 'Do not cease to cry out to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines.'" You see the attitude difference there? In one, the first one, chapter 4, they don't consult God at all. They don't ask for God's permission. They don't ask for God's help. "Bring the Ark of the Covenant. Let's win this battle." Chapter 7 is a very different attitude. Samuel, please ask God to save us. Maybe he will. Please pray to him for us that he might save us from this enemy. There's much more humility in Israel's attitude as we go through this transition from one battle to the Philistines to the other. They're humble. They care about what God thinks. They want to be pleasing to God. We're in chapter 4, they just didn't care. Who won the battle in chapter 7? Just like he won the battle in the previous example, God is the one who wins the battle. Israel doesn't really do anything. I mean, they do kind of chase him, I guess. 1 Samuel 7, 9 through 12. "So Samuel took a nursing lamb and offered it as a burnt offering before the Lord. And Samuel cried out to the Lord of Israel, for Israel, and the Lord answered him. And as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near and attacked. But the Lord thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines and threw them into confusion." God's doing all the heavy lifting. And so while the Philistines are all confused because of this mighty thunderous sound, it's interesting, I don't know how that would have worked. Did the Israelites hear the sound too? Or did it just happen to the Philistines? I don't know. I don't know how all the details about how this works. But as the Philistines are all in confusion and mass panic and chaos, Israel just comes in and mops them up. God's the one who won the battle. God's the one who did all the work. Without God, they would have lost again. But I think because of this attitude readjustment, because this time they were humble, this time they cared about what God wanted, this time they wanted to be pleasing to God, God has a different way of working it out for them. But notice as we go throughout this book, and we're going to see this, this is perhaps the one through line of 1 Samuel. Really 2 Samuel too. 1 and 2 Samuel. A pattern of failing fathers. We notice in 8:1-4, Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, the name of his second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba, yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Who does this remind you of? Doesn't this remind you of Eli's sons? As we've read several times already, Eli's sons, as they were just as bad, they were just as inept, I should say. Now, Eli, this is in chapter 2 then, 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 22. Now, Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing in all Israel, how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and there's a number of things that they were doing as well, but this is a good example of it. We're going to see a pattern of failing fathers throughout Samuel. Of course, we know who's next, right? Isn't Saul next? Of course, we know that. Hindsight's 20/20. You can just read ahead and see it. But Saul, as he's chosen to be king, doesn't he also fail as a father? Tries to kill his own son. Tries to kill his son's best friend. Then we come to David. David, who was a great guy, by all accounts, and yet his sons turned away after other gods. Didn't care about justice, didn't care about God's righteousness. What we see in Samuel is a pattern over and over of failing fathers. I don't know why that is, but it is interesting to note. Righteous men whose children did not follow God. Just a note that we'll keep seeing that as we go on. God already knows. In this instance of this instance of Israel asking for a king, it's not like God didn't anticipate this possibility. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 17, if you want to turn there, Deuteronomy chapter 17 is Moses is talking to the people. This is way before any of this is a possibility. This is before they've entered the land of Canaan, before all these battles and all these judges, before all this great stuff has taken place for Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 14. And when you come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then you say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me. And you may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. And then he goes on about all these different qualifications for kings, all the things that the kings need to be doing. These are the laws concerning the kings of Israel. Might I suggest, your sins are not original. The ways that we rebel against God, the ways that we reject Him, the ways that we refuse to serve Him, God knows that you're going to do them. The beauty of Christianity, the beauty of God's love, is that He knows you're going to mess up and still wants to have a relationship with you anyway. He knows that we're not perfect. He knows the ways that we're going to fail. And yet He still sent His Son for us. That is the beauty of God's love. Just like Israel, He knew they were going to reject Him. And you can see it back in 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 8, you can feel the Lord's disappointment, can't you? You can feel His sadness. Chapter 8, verse 7. And the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being a king over them. Just because God knew it was a possibility doesn't mean it hurts any less. Just because God knows I might sin doesn't mean it hurts Him less. Doesn't mean it disappoints Him less. But God still loves us anyway, just like He still loved Israel. Rejecting God's prophets is equal to rejecting God himself. Samuel felt slighted, and I understand that. Verse 6, this thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king. Samuel feels rejected, as he should. They are rejecting Samuel. But the point is deeper than that. Rejecting God's prophet is the same as rejecting God himself. That applies a lot to us, I think, today. Why? Wasn't this all written by prophets? Especially the New Testament, as we think about the covenant that we have with God, given to us by the apostles and prophets that Jesus himself chose. When we reject those apostles, when we reject God's prophets, we are rejecting God himself. And that should be terrifying. Read this again, 1 Samuel 7:10 through 13. As Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to attack Israel. But the Lord thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines, threw them into confusion, and they were defeated before Israel. And the men of Israel went out from Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them as far as below Beth-Kar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen and called its name Ebenezer. For he said, till now the Lord has helped us. So the Philistines were subdued and did not again enter the territory of Israel, and the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. Why do we reject God as king? As we look at Israel, we're asking the question, why did Israel reject? But Israel's reasons are the same as our own. Why do we reject God from being king over our lives? Why do we reject God's authority, not just on Sunday and Wednesday, but why do I reject his authority on a daily basis? Why do I refuse to let him have dominion over my life? For the same reasons Israel does. Verses 1 through 4 of 1 Samuel, all these are in 1 Samuel, 8, 1 through 4. Particularly verse 4, then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. The excuse was Samuel's sons, wasn't it? They rejected God because of Samuel's son's behavior. Just like we reject God because of the failures of others. A lot of people refuse to listen to God's word because of the failings of Christians. It's a sad thing, isn't it? When our hypocrisy drives people away from God, that should be so sad to us. It should be so heart-wrenching to us. They rejected because of the failures of others, because of Samuel's son's failings. They rejected God because they wanted to fit in. Twice we see this. Verse 5, now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. Then in verse 20 again, verse 19 rather, but the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us that we may be like all the nations. You know what's so interesting to me about this? They had just watched God annihilate the Philistines. They had just watched the whole thing with the Ark of the Covenant, man. This whole story with the Ark of the Covenant and God basically, without any help at all, afflicting the Philistines over and over again, and the cart just miraculously comes back. They had just seen how awesome God is, but they still wanted to fit in. They wanted to be like all the other nations. If I'm being the Israelites, I do not want to be like the Philistines who just got destroyed. I don't want to be like them. But they wanted to be like the nations around them. Which, might I suggest, is one of the primary reasons that we reject God today. It's because we want to be like the people around us. We don't want to be distinct. We don't want to be separate from the world. We don't want to stand out. We want to blend in, because blending in is easy, right? Being just like everyone else, means that we don't have these extra expectations on us. We don't have people questioning us. We don't have people mocking us. We don't have people ridiculing us. It's easier to fit in. Selfishness, 8:20. Not only did they want to be like all the nations, that we may be like the nations, but that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Why did they want a king? Because they were tired of fighting their own battles. They didn't want to do it anymore. It was really just a selfish thing. They wanted somebody else to do it for them. Why do we reject God? Now, this is, of course, a symptom of something deeper, right? Of my desires and what I want being more important than what God says. When I put my own desires, when I put my own, whatever it is that I want, could be desires professionally, could be desires in my family, could be desires in my personal life, whatever I want to put there, when I start putting that ahead of God, then of course I'm going to reject Him as King. Of course I'm going to reject Him as Sovereign. I don't want to do what God wants, I want to do what I want. Just like Israel rejecting God. But finally, I think that really the biggest thing, that the biggest problem that Israel had was forgetfulness. Did they not just see God be awesome in His dealings with the Philistines? Were they unfamiliar with all the things that God had done in the book of Judges? Not that they had the book of Judges, but all the history of Israel. They would have had the oral traditions. All these various judges that had judged Israel throughout the years and all the great things that God has done. Things were going pretty good. And you see this as Israel's problem over and over again throughout their history. Even in the book of Judges, this is very clear. The judge is there. He does great. He leads the people of Israel. And then what? Then they fall away. They go away from God. They forget about the judges. They forget about what He did. And then the next generation forgets God and goes and does their own thing. And then they need somebody to come save them again. This is the pattern of Israel. Israel keeps forgetting how awesome God is. And they keep forgetting that when they serve Him, things tend to go pretty great. Just like we forget all the ways that God blesses us when we allow Him to be our King. We forget how awesome things can be. We forget the peace that we have, the hope that we have, the love that we have. All of those awesome benefits of being in the kingdom of God, we forget them. Things get in the way. Things become more important. Things take precedence. Of course, the implication, the question behind all these, are these good enough reasons? Not to God. Not good enough. Guess what? Christians are going to fail. We do it all the time. People who claim to love God, who claim to serve Him, they are going to make mistakes. Rather big ones, I might add. But your relationship with God exists independently of those people. Just because somebody else does something wrong doesn't mean that you suddenly get an excuse not to love God and serve God. Just because you want to fit in, again, not a good enough reason to reject God when God calls you to something so much better. I don't want to be with everybody else in the afterlife, so why would I want to be with everybody else right now? Talk about selfishness, man. Was God selfish when He sent His Son to die? Was God selfish in all of the ways that He blesses us? These are not good enough reasons to reject God as King. Even though these things do happen, I know. Until now, the Lord has helped us. This Ebenezer stone, this is an interesting stone. Some of you might have a footnote here in chapter 7, verse 12. I have a footnote. Ebenezer means stone of help. That's what he's doing, literally raising a stone. This is a memorial, isn't it? What was the point of the Ebenezer stone? To remind people why they should be faithful to God. What does he say in verse 12? Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen, called its name Ebenezer, for he said, till now or thus far the Lord has helped us. And the implication there being, God has given you a great victory over the Philistines. Let that inspire you for the future. Remember how great God was today so that you can be faithful to God tomorrow and the day after that and the day after that. To remind people what God had done for them. And every time they passed this stone, this Ebenezer, every time they passed this memorial, it would be a reminder to them, oh yeah, God's amazing. Oh yeah, God's wonderful. What am I doing? Why am I straying away? Remember that time that God routed the Philistines with that great thundering sound? That was awesome. That's what this is designed to do. To help them remember what God had done for them. But instead, what did it become? It became a turning point in the nation's identity. Until now, the Lord has helped us, has been our King. but no more. They made this stone, this Ebenezer, instead of something that would remind them of the ways that God has helped them, instead it kind of became an end stone, a cap on the time of the judges. The time when the people let God be their king. The time when Israel just had a direct relationship with God. This Ebenezer ended up being kind of the end of that. Until now, the Lord has helped us, but from now on, our king will help us. They took this, and it was unintentional, I'm sure they didn't think it through, but they twisted this Ebenezer into something that it should not have been. And really, it became, in my eyes, as I read this story, it becomes kind of a sad thing. They had done so well with the judges up through this point, but because of their forgetfulness, because of their selfishness, their desire to fit in, this became a turning point for them. And as we know, what happens with the kings? Over and over and over again, as we go throughout the rest of the book of Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings, and 1 and 2 Chronicles, we see all the disasters that come from this story. From this decision. Rejecting God has consequences. We'll read this now, 1 Samuel 8:10-18. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king over him, for a king from him. He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you." This is your warning, guys. "He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to plow his ground and some to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants. He will take your male servants and his female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys and will put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your flocks and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you." They thought this king thing would be great. Yeah, give us a king. Let us be like all the other nations. Let him fight our battles for us. Not realizing all of the consequences that would come from this decision. Might I add, sometimes it is sorely tempting to reject God. We think our life will be better if I don't have to live under God's authority. There are a host of hidden consequences. Because when we reject God as king, we think we're serving ourselves. But the only other option, isn't that the devil? And he lets our life be pretty good, I guess. But there's all these hidden costs. Broken families, broken homes. Our personal lives are worse, our relationships are worse. Everything gets worse when we refuse to serve God as king. And ultimately, verse 18 is a poignant reminder, a poignant warning, I think, for us today. In that day, the day when you finally realize what an idiot you were for rejecting God. That's what Samuel's saying. You guys are being dumb. In that day when you finally realize what a terrible mistake you've made, you will cry out because of your choice, but God will not answer. Fortunately for us, that day has not yet come. You can realize that today, that you've been making the wrong choice, cry out to him, and good news, he will indeed respond. You have until Judgment Day to make that choice.